Hey, listeners, it's your host, Abir Sichter, a.k.a. Bengali Dove. February is Youth Leadership Month, and I'm thrilled to bring you a conversation with the youngest guest ever featured on Local Global Leaders. This episode is titled, It's Complicated, But It Worked Out, and I spoke with Nicholas Hazlett, a Morehead State University student, chair of the Johnson County Democratic Party, and Paintsville, Kentucky City Council member. Councilmember Hazlett is a proud Eastern Kentuckian. And at his young age, he's already stepped into public service in the very community where I grew up. We dug into everything from accountability and leadership to how he navigates party politics, to how he stays independent in his leadership style, and perhaps most importantly, the deep family roots that shape his commitment to uplifting Eastern Kentucky and Johnson County. You may also notice my dogs chiming in a few times in the background. They were downstairs, but were very enthusiastic to hear the conversation, and they didn't realize the recorder could pick up their enthusiasm. Now, let's get into the conversation. Greetings, listeners. This is Abir Sichter. I'm back home today in Johnson County, interviewing my first guest here in Johnson County, Councilman Nicholas Hazlett. Councilman, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So excited to have such an inspirational young leader who's leading out here in Eastern Kentucky and doing the amazing work you're doing. And I've heard, you know, so much about the work you're doing, been following local news here. Just excited to hear when you got elected and just excited to hear your story.
Yeah, it was definitely a whirlwind experience, but I'm very glad to be able to serve my hometown that, you know, this is the only place I've known and the place that I hope that I can, you know, continue to serve and live in for the rest of my life. I'm one of those people that when you grow up in the mountains, it's hard to leave them. So I'm one of those folks that I'll be arrogant and I'll just live here the rest of my life. And people would just have to deal with that.
I can feel that. I got to do school out in D.C. for a while and got to live out in Memphis for a while. But I always felt like the calling to come back here, to be back in Kentucky.
Exactly. Even when I visit my family in Bristol, Tennessee or Bristol, Virginia, both sets of the family live on two different sides because the city split. You know, anywhere in the Appalachian Mountains feels better than anywhere else. And just my humble opinion, it's a weird connection that a lot of people talk about. You know, what if the semblance of place there? But you know, this is just like anywhere else in the world. If I were from a different place, you know, just having that comfort and that being. But there's nowhere better than East Kentucky, in my humble opinion.
That's true. Definitely true. Starting out with your story, I always like to ask my guests, what is your six-word story? Six words you'd use to describe yourself.
It's complicated, but it worked out.
Yeah. What motivates you to be back here in Eastern Kentucky, but overall, what motivates you to be a leader here in your community and led you to run for office?
Well, there's things that I know in the past that we should have done that we hadn't. You know, whether it's revitalizing our economy beyond coal and lumber, you know, industries we knew realistically behind closed doors were not going to last. But we, for all intents and purposes, you know, took a blind eye to it and continued to, you know, drill out our mines and flatten them for something that we knew was not going to be sustainable. You know, and I'm not saying we can't be an energy capital. We most certainly are, like West Virginia. My mom's side of the family were coal miners. But, you know, going to a community that I know has so much potential with what we have, you know, not just for tourism and just our general history here and culture, but also dealing with the fact that, you know, we can't lose community. You know, I think especially since COVID, we've lost a lot of functions that small towns, I think, have taken for granted, of the amenities that we had, of the community groups. And then also just dealing with the generation behind me. You know, I'm Gen Z, but my sister's almost 11 at the 11th of December. And, you know, I worry for her what will happen, you know, for most of these Eastern Kentucky communities if we don't get our act together. So it's not just preserving what we've had and what we continue to have, but, you know, improving it to make sure we don't continue to have the population loss that we've suffered for the last 20, 30 years.
It's interesting to hear that you as a young leader, as a Gen Z leader, already thinking about future generations.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is for me is I feel as if that I could come home and I would be content. with whatever the circumstances are. But I know that when you're dealing with a generation that had, you know, kindergarten COVID, I mean, she was managing some of the most developmental times in a child, you know, behind a screen. I feel as if that, you know, they were starting life at the wrong foot. And I don't feel as if that we should allow them to keep hitting speed bumps along the way, whether it is that they have to go out for education or go out for a job because there is no possibility of staying here, that you should only have to leave Eastern Kentucky or any rural area because you want to, not because you're forced to. So that's my thing. I can be content. I can go home right now and live the rest of my days and not worry about it. But, you know, growing up of, you know, not expecting to have a sibling. And then when you're 9 years old, you come up with a little sister. It's always been that guiding light to me to make sure that she and others like her have that more secure future than, you know, they were dealt.
Sounds like she's very lucky to have an older brother like
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I will say it's, I don't, you know, as many of them say, I'm kind of out of touch with what, you know, Gen Alpha would subscribe to, you know, all of the different references and online trends, but I try and keep up as best as possible. I already feel like I'm carbon dated at the age of 20, so it just happens that way.
You know, thinking about you running for office, and you've talked about that family motivation, you know, before college and before you like ran for city council, what were your early experiences in leadership, particularly in school?
In school, I was on Paintsville's academic team. I was in choir. And then I was on student council off and on for a number of years. And when I was in elementary school up until about seventh grade, my dad was on the school board at Paintsville. So not only seeing what he contributed to our school system and Jeff community and him running from something where he lost a city council election by, I think it was about 4 or 5 votes to him, you know, being the highest vote getter for city council, that kind of gave me that security and that confidence to do it, because if he can do it, then I might as well give it a shot. But also just seeing, you know, when you graduate in the high school class of 46 people, you know, you have to compromise, because if you don't know somebody, you're just avoiding them. And if you want to do anything, especially as small of our community is, and fundraise or come up with a plan or make things better, you have to be in some kind of collective group and have a, you know, structured goal. So I think that was just ordained to me by circumstance, going to Paintsville and going and living in a small community with a very small city school, but also just dealing with the issues at home too, you know, dealing with a small family that always needed to, you know, pick up a piece, whether it's, you know, taking somebody to the doctor, taking care of groceries, making sure that they're okay, and just checking in on them. I think that just close-knit nature is really what kind of gave me the idea that, you know, no one's coming to save us. And if we want to, you know, change something for our region, we have to do it ourselves.
How do you balance being like both a student and your leadership responsibilities on city council and is also leading the county Democratic Party here?
It's a struggle to say the least, but I think realistically it is a good one. I think, and even when I've talked to Mayor Runyon and Tim Hall, who is my neighbor and colleague on the city council, you know, that work-life balance is something that we've kind of lost in elected government. You know, typically the age in local government in these areas is around the age of 60. You know, I'm lucky to serve with Ava Hobrook as well, who's a single mom that's, you know, taking care of the home front there with a career in pharmacy. So I think bringing that perspective means a lot. You know, given those challenges of population, you know, decrease and seeing so many, you know, the brain drain that were occurring. And this is not new. I mean, it has been happening for decades. I mean, even when my papa went to the University of Pikeville, that was a concern as well, because people were just now, then in the 50s and late 40s after World War II, were given the opportunity to not just be relegated to farming and coal mining and working in the railroad. You know, they were able to go to some post-secondary option or move somewhere else for a better job. You know, a lot of my family on my mom's side went to Dayton, Ohio, and Wabash, Indiana for factory jobs. So it's the same thing, but a different, you know, turnkey experience for people. You know, that was 70 years ago, but unfortunately a lot of things are still similar and common in East Kentucky of why families are put the way that they are. But that balance is something that I feel that is necessary, just because, you know, we had a dormant Democratic Party. It had not been active since 2019. And when I went to the county convention about a month after I graduated, they said, well, we've been thinking and we, you know, see what you're about. They've known me since I was a kid, and they just felt as if that I had the spirit to be chair. And I told them, I said, this is not a one-man job. I'm going to need a lot of help and hands and wisdom along the way, because many of them had been chair or been within the committee, like Dr. Majasek, that taught at McSandy for a great number of years, and he is still a really great resource for me. So, you know, it's making sure that our community, you know, it's not really a political job to me. It is not one of, you know, Democrats are this and Republicans are this and that kind of opposing viewpoint. It's just that we need to have a balanced politic in the United States. You know, we can't have communities that are completely lopsided on one way or the other, whether it's an urban area that votes 80% Democratic or it's a rural area that's voting 80% Republican. I think that we have to, you know, rightfully, right now in the, you know, everyone says this, the divided times that we live in, you know, have that balance and that semblance of both sides willing to cater to every voter, whether it's a rural voter, suburban, or an urban voter. And, you know, my family on my dad's side have been kind of the traditional, what would be called now a McCain Republican family. And my mom's side, very much, you know, Blue Dog Democrats, you know, very much working class, unionized Democrats of what would some people say of a dying breed, but it's still here. It's just a matter of getting those folks out to vote and continuing that relationship that Democrats have had when it comes to labor and working families. So it just goes hand in hand, in my opinion. But I know a lot of people, of course, would disagree with that fact. But, you know, the thing is, if you want young people involved, you can't just want young people that, you know, subscribe to your ideas. You have to be willing to allow young people to be in every space with whatever opinion they may hold.
And how much do you look at what's happening with the statewide Democratic Party and the Republican Party too? And then like the national, the DNC and the RNC, mm-hmm. like what they're doing, like do you try to adhere to the DNC's guidance, or do you kind of feel like you're doing your own thing? Or
I do my own thing. And it's not to the chagrin of the DNC or the Kentucky Democratic Party, KDP. They have, you know, within KDP, whether it's Chair Eldridge or our executive director, Morgan Eaves, or any of their staff members for communications or elsewhere, have always told me to, you know, consider and cater your party to your area. Not, you know, the messaging of Louisville is not going to resonate in Paintsville. You know, and even the messaging in Paintsville is not going to resonate in Louisville. We all have different abject challenges. We have different stances in life. You know, we have different beginnings and backgrounds. You know, you can't talk about, you know, the importance of coal in our urban area, you know, but you can also talk about, you know, certain social issues in Eastern Kentucky, not because people don't agree with those fronts, but that they're coming from two different areas. And I've always said that, you know, the Democratic Party still is, regardless of what the pundits may say with their spreadsheets and their opinions, you know, from both beltways of California and New York, that the Democratic Party still and will hopefully continue to be that beacon for working families. You know, I believe in the mantra that we have always stood for since Roosevelt, you know, during the Great Depression. That is one reason why our party had such a semblance of strength for decades, up until about the 1980s when you saw slippage with Reagan and else. But I think that when you're talking about, you know, how do you cater to people in Eastern Kentucky, you talk about the things that clearly are not being focused on right now. You know, right now, especially on the federal level, you're getting this kind of, what if the new term, gaslighting. You know, everybody loves talking about gaslighting these days, whether it's a personal relationship or messaging that's trying to convey some kind of condescending nature to people, whatever it may be, that things are cheaper than they were. And the problem is that they're not. And it's not just me saying that because that's what the Democratic Party is saying. It's just the truth. When I go to the grocery store for whether myself, for my family, for my grandparents, it is not in a place of affordability, you know, increasing for families. You know, one of the things that I saw the other day, people talking about the price of eggs went down, you know, well, that's great and all, but when everything else has jacked up, but also the stabilization of those prices. You know, eggs only went down about 5-10 cents. You know, at the end of the day, if 5-10 cents going to be relief for families when everything else has exacerbated their prices. Gasoline has pretty much been the only thing that has went down, but still, it's about $3 a gallon. So the problem that I see with the Republican Party is not that Republican voters know it's a problem. They do. Polling has shown that they don't believe that the messaging and the promises that were made are fulfilling themselves at this moment. Mm-hmm. And we're almost a year in. And at this point, you know, they've already talked about if it already a lame duck presidency, if things just hoping that they get better, you know, if they're a magic ball, you know, what if they're going to do to save it? I think the question is, why are Republican elected officials not willing to say this? Mm-hmm. You know, the Republican voters I know, and this is not just, you know, I go up and knock on somebody's door. It's people I know on the daily that I talk to. They know that things aren't getting better. And, you know, the question will be, will these people vote for a Democrat for, you know, well, clearly things are not going well on our side of the aisle. Maybe it's time to bring it change, or are they going to vote at all? You know, there's been talk about voter fatigue on the conservative side, and I could very well see it. You know, when you were promised for 3 consistent election cycles that promises are going to be made and they're going to be kept. And we're now a year into the second run of this, you know, philosophy. And things are still not getting better wholesale. It is hard to see why people would be enthusiastic on the Republican side to vote, unless it's just to preserve the Congress that they currently have or the powers that they currently have. But I think a lot of people in Eastern Kentucky, it's not a political issue. Mm. You know, when you cut SNAP, when you close in rural hospitals, it's not political. It's just the daily life and death circumstances of living in a rural community. You know, I know that some conservative pundits have said, well, I have private insurance, so I'm going to be okay. Well, a closure of a hospital doesn't care if you have private insurance or public insurance through Medicaid or Medicare. All that matters is that are they getting the reimbursement money that keeps them afloat. So I think this is going to disproportionately hurt East Kentucky and rural America. And, you know, some people will say, well, this is what they voted for. That's not. They were told that prices were going to lower. They were told that things would be better. And I think that when you talk about, you know, why do they think that, when they looked at the economy of Trump in 2019 and 2020, what was the biggest thing that happened in 2020? COVID. The economy cratered organically because of COVID, rightfully. You know, everybody was out of work. You know, the entire trade system was completely run amok. And I think you had this brain fog, not from COVID, but the brain fog of just everything going on. Mm-hmm. It was so overwhelming that people do not remember how bad things were in 2018 and 2019. And I think now people are slowly remembering that stalemate and that stagnation because it is happening again. So I'm interested to see what happens in the midterms. I really do think that there's going to be a lot of rural Democrats that are going to do very well, even here in Eastern Kentucky. But I think it's the matter of being that consistent affordability message. And the things that have hurt the Democratic Party in rural areas, like social issues, I've told people consistently that are interested in running for office or already running for office. The thing is, on social issues in a rural area, most people privately will agree with you. But I think the problem is when Democrats open the conversation with a social issue, because it looks like we don't know what you're talking about, that we're not being realistic to the needs of the people about affordability and lowering costs and just making a better quality of life. Now, if a Republican says something abhorrent about a certain sect of the population, about, you know, a practice, whether it be abortion or guns or whatever it may be, then that's when you take on the offensive and you be clear about where we stand or where you individually stand. We may have different opinions. You know, there's pro-gun Democrats, there's pro-life Democrats, whatever your stance may be. But by opening the door with a social issue, you're completely negating the main top priority of Americans is lowering cost. So I think that is where the affordability message will lie in our policy. It's just the question, will every individual candidate take that advice and run with it? Because if they do, I think they will win or come pretty darn close in areas that they realistically in the past couple of years shouldn't even be remotely competitive. So I think we will see some changes. It's just a matter of getting the right people on the ballot and getting the right team behind them.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate, like, yeah, hearing your optimism and your forward views for that. It's interesting. Just last week, I interviewed Secretary of State Michael Adams, mm-hmm. and he mentioned that, like, he's seen the shift. Like, growing up, the Democratic Party was the labor union party, the pro-working class family party. But, like, the Republican Party has kind of taken up that mantra. But, you know, you still see those roots.
I see the roots. And I think that a lot of people, you know, the thing is, too, is when people look at Kentucky and say it cannot vote Democratic. Well, it did in 2023. It did in 2019. And it voted for Democratic causes against Amendment 2 in 2024 to completely roll back public education funding going into private schools with no oversight. In 2022, we voted down an amendment that would have completely ripped away, you know, a woman's right to choose. In whatever belief system people have on that issue, that would have completely taken the option off the table for us to even reconsider. And I think that was too extreme for Kentucky. You know, we want to be able to make our own decisions at the ballot box. And by completely wiping that out of any consideration within a referendum in the future or by a piece of legislation, that was just a step too far. And I think when we're talking about, you know, the Democratic Party's shifting away, you know, you can talk about when did it happen? Did you see it in 1968? You know, whatever year or whatever election people want to pinpoint. But I think at the same time, you know, Kentucky have voted and other rural states have voted for Democratic governors, congresspeople, and senators in not a very short amount of time from now. You know, we're talking about John Tester in Montana, Sherrod Brown in Ohio. He's running again. We'll see where that goes. But, you know, I was told that Governor Beshear was not going to win in 2023, that I was just having wishful thinking that his rural support would completely disintegrate because of, one, the Trump effect, and then, you know, the issues of people blabbering about, you know, the COVID handling that he had and everything else. And then when the returns came in, I sent them photos and said, you know, I'm not here to say that you're wrong, but I believe you're wrong. And then when they finally called the election, I sent it to them and I said, you were wrong. So, you know, I was being very hopefully optimistic. And I do believe that we have seen some slippage because, you know, our message hasn't been always coherent. It hasn't always been stable. It has been one that is very sporadic. And I think that we have to make sure that we have the core values, but we allow politicians to deviate. You know, the things that are going to work in West Virginia are not going to work in California. You know, we have differing priorities for a 50-state strategy that I think that we have to have. You know, but the support of unions and, you know, lowering costs and better opportunities for families is what we should be striving for. Now, how you get to that better reality is up to you as a candidate and whatever, you know, comes to your state. The needs of your state and your people. But that underlying theme, I think, should be completely universal. And to the issue of, you know, labor, you know, shifting towards the Republican Party, I think in the last little bit, I talked to a union leader that said a lot of his membership were worried about and very, you know, celebratory of the bill that they passed that would allow no tax on tips and no tax on overtime. Well, when their check stubs came in, they were still getting deducted. To me, it seems as if that it is very much a carrot on the stick to get a lot of labor organizations to support candidates, to get them through the door. And then once they get elected, you know, that complete support of labor just dissolves completely. You know, I've always given people this idea when you talk about labor that are supporting Republicans or certain minority groups that are supporting Republicans. I say you may get them in the castle, but they're going to up the drawbridge and they're going to be left outside. You got them in the door, but that doesn't mean they're going to welcome you in either. And that's been the thing that I think we've seen with a lot of unions slowly but surely going back to the Democratic cause or just not endorsing a candidate, being completely neutral in elections where they used to, you know, overwhelmingly endorse a Democrat. They've now shifted to overwhelmingly endorsing a Republican. Now they're in, you know, this conundrum, this problem and predicament. And I think that if we have the right candidates, that labor will follow suit with us. But it's the matter of not just expecting labor to endorse a Democrat, but it is working hard to, you know, appeal to those constituencies, not just assuming that, you know, I can go, you know, put on a hard hat and, you know, get in the campaign ad and expect the union to endorse me, but I have to have teeth to my words. You know, they have to, you know, your words follow up your actions and your actions follow up your words. And I think that that is really the predicament that we have, is not only just saying that we promised that we would be for labor, but acting upon that as well. And that's what the Republicans have promised to do. And, you know, right now we see union busting going on. We see, you know, these check stubs that were supposed to be much larger for people in their pockets, and they're not really materializing that way. So I think calling those out, but also giving a clear plan of what we're for, not just what we're against.
And it's so interesting, like, you know, like, you've grown up and you've experienced this and you've heard from people, but you're also, like, also a college student, am I correct, studying political science?
Yeah.
So, like, it's, you know, I imagine, like for me, like, people study political science and think, oh, in the future I'll run for office or do political work, but, like, you're doing it while studying political science. Like, how is that, like, affecting your leadership?
It's interesting. It opens up my mind to other ideas that I previously wouldn't thought. And I know that there's people in leadership positions, especially at the local level, that didn't go to the collegiate level, and they're running their cities and their, you know, local governments pretty darn good. But just in my opinion, going through a collegiate level of study while also being in an elected position have kind of opened up the ideas of, you know, what we have done in the past, what does work, what doesn't work, and kind of new broader ideas that have just come to play. So, you know, considering different issues, whether it's food deserts, you know, healthcare unavailability, whatever these things may be, that is, you know, new concepts for rural politics, but also considering that we have a unique position growing up in the area that we do. You know, I love this place, but sometimes we can be our worst enemy. You know, sometimes we put down ourselves into the point of not really wanting to do anything, but having those new ideas constantly flowing and dealing with people from all different walks of life in a collegiate space. You know, coming from cities that have thousands of people, you know, hundreds of thousands, to where we have just a little over 4,000 people. So, you know, having those broadening perspectives of what works in a rural area, and what works in a, you know, suburban area or urban area, and making sure that we can either link those together in some form or fashion, or just see, hey, this doesn't work in a rural area when I previously thought it would. Maybe let's shift focus. So I think not just in the studies and the work and the assignments and group projects, but also just talking to people from their point of view of where they've lived and what they've experienced. So, you know, it is a lot when you have your city council meetings on the second Monday and, you know, you have to go to class that morning and then drive back home and then go back to campus. But, you know, it's a burden that I'm willing to take for a while, because I feel as if that experience of being young in an area like this that have consistently seen an aging population, that have, you know, not really seen a lot of young people, you know, unfortunately step up in a local way. You know, a lot of them go off and they go and do great things. You know, they become doctors, they go in the military, they do something that, you know, completely shifts their focus out of East Kentucky. But not a lot of people have been able to come back and make a success story of it, or have been able to exploit that. So I think that just using the story that I have and carrying that with other people's concerns is really the important thing that I, you know, have really been able to gain from, you know, balancing that work-school-life balance that I've had for the last little bit.
And you've, you know, it sounds like you've had very positive relationships, like, with fellow city council members, with the local leaders here. Mm-hmm. Have you ever encountered, like, toxic leadership in your career, and how has it affected you?
There's a lot of people that I will say, had I been 10 years older, I think I would have been taken more seriously. Mm-hmm. But also, I can't blame them. It isn't, you know, for far too long, you know, the average expectation of a local leader, whether it's city council or school board or mayor or, you know, even in county government, is, you know, you settle down, you have kids, you have a, you know, a business or a career where you're pretty much foundational to the community, and then you put your name in the hat. Not doing it beforehand. And establishing yourself of just ideas, you know, an experience that may not even be on paper. You know, I have, you know, proudly been able to do good things for the community, but has it been notated on a, you know, a resume? No. Because I haven't had that, you know, textbook experience that people would typically consider. But, you know, I've lived here my entire life for almost 21 years now. My entire family have either lived in Paintsville or Johnson County since, I mean, you know, the 1860s, mm-hmm. when we left Roanoke, Virginia, because we didn't, you know, support the secession from the Union. And we were in Johnson and McGoffin counties at the time, and, you know, this is where we are still. So, you know, the idea that I don't have the lived experience to be able to form an opinion or a framework for a policy that will help is really tone deaf, in my opinion. You know, there's even people in their 60s that don't have a lot of written experience, but when you throw them in a decision-making role, they can do very well. Mm-hmm. You know, age, in my opinion, if not a factor, it's how new your ideas are or how willing you are to accept new ideas. Because we cannot live in a framework of the 1970s and 80s. Those years have unfortunately passed, and I get it. We live in a community that was in pretty good straits, you know, in the 20th century. But you can't put a 20th century thought into a 24th century reality. You know, we have to have new ideas. And whether that comes from me as the youngest person or from the oldest person on the council does not matter to me. But I have seen, you know, instances, whether it's, you know, being county Democratic Party chair, being on city council, or even just running for office. There's a lot of people saying, does he even live here? And I'm like, yes, I live here. Just because I have a dorm 5 days a week at Morehead State University doesn't mean my legal address is here in the city of Paintsville. And I showed them my address. And a lot of these people know where I live. And it was this interesting back and forth. And I think it is that they just didn't want to have a young person in the role. You know, they wanted somebody that, you know, was in what they would normally call the good old boys club. But, you know, that's not what the city of Paintsville wanted. No one else filed for writing candidacy. No one else filed for that vacant seat that I then took. So, you know, the idea that there were better options, there were no options. So I was there to step up and do good for my community. And, you know, we have an election next November. If you feel as if somebody else is better for that and I end up not getting in the top six slate, so be it. But at this moment, that was my calling and that was what I believed was right for the city of Paintsville. And that's what over 150 people wrote in my name for. So unless those people have, you know, concerns going into the next election of my, you know, feasibility of being on that council of six and governing the city in the right way, then, you know, that's the will of the voter and the will of the people. But at this moment, that was what was clear to me, is that if no one else was willing to step up for the city of Paintsville and put their name to the ballot and offer themselves as a candidate, I might as well have done it. And that's exactly why I'm here today. But I do think that there was an issue of age in that. And some people have been proven wrong, and that's fine. You know, I'm glad to show them that, you know, things are better than they seemed. You know, that I'm not naive and I have pie-in-the-sky ideas. I'm pretty practical. I understand that there are issues in local government when you have a budget of a little over $2.5 million. You know, there's a lot of limitations and there's not a lot of money to go around. So this idea that I would swoop in there and, you know, cause chaos was not to be perceived by a lot of people because it wasn't going to happen. I knew realistically what I was going into. So I do see age being a problem, but I'm glad to see that for most people that seems to have persisted.
When you said about if you were 10 years older, it just made me think of something I heard. One of Barack Obama's advisors told shared a story that after, like, Trump got elected, after, you know, succeeding him, that he had this thought of, maybe I came 10 years too soon. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe I should have come later. So, it's, you know, I know it's a different perspective, but just made me think of that, quote of, like, you know, when we take that step or have that calling mm-hmm. to run for office or to take an initiative, like, you know, you saw that calling and you went for it and you saw the time.
No, exactly. I told myself, I said, I may very well lose. Somebody else may have filed. They may appoint somebody to that seat and I may lose. But the reality is that I was willing to put my name on the ballot. And whether people voted for me or not, I promised to serve them. You know, and there were a lot of people that had issue that I was running as, you know, the Democrat in Johnson County. You know, that's what people have labeled me on Facebook if you look at the select few that always come to the comments. but I think when you look at my practice, it's not a political reason that I'm there. And even the stuff that I do in being a county chair, it's that I believe that everybody deserves a voice in the process. And, you know, they don't have to vote for a Democrat. They don't have to donate to us. They don't have to support us. But the reality is, I believe that we should have every option on the table to move our city and our county forward, because clearly things are not going well as they are currently, as they were at the time. So I believe that we should have all options on the table, whether that is in a partisan way, you know, with, you know, Democrats running, or in the idea of just bringing every different perspective to the table in the smallest facet of government. You know, city council, school board, you know, the very, in my opinion, some of the most important decisions are made there. You know, people say, you know, it's the most important election of your lifetime when they're thinking of a Senate race or the presidential. It very well is. But the majority of the issues that impact you on the daily, whether it's roads, issues of housing, you know, cost of living, a lot of those things are decided at the most local level. And so that was why I decided to take that, you know, that big leap, if a lot of people wanted to call it for me. But I was glad to jump for it because I think that we have a good group of six right now. And I think that there will be another group of six coming in January 27 that will continue to do that.
What would you say is your overall leadership style or philosophy?
My idea is, one, is that since I've not been there for a number of years, if establishing these relationships as if they've always known me. I don't want somebody to come in and have to spoon feed me information. I don't want somebody to come in and think because I'm young or I'm new that I don't know, you know, the situations that are at hand, whether they are severe issues or they're things that just need tweaks or need new perspectives on. And a lot of these people within city government I've known because I was with their kids in school. I knew them, you know, just in a family setting, a personal way. So I just want them to level with me. You know, this is a town of 4,000. You don't need to give me acronyms. You don't need to give me fancy ways of explaining it. Just give me, you know, the root way and the root cause of the issue and we'll fix it. I'm also one of these people that I don't like taking no for an answer. And I don't like the idea of just waiting for things to pan out. I like to have a concrete framework and I like to see things that are practical but yet big and bold. Because we have to be able to exacerbate what we have. Because realistically, you know, when you're dealing with an issue of utilities, available land, there's not going to be a factory just drop in Johnson County and save, you know, the local economy. But what we do have is just our natural tourism. What we do have is very good-hearted small businesses. We have really good county and city schools. And I think that we have to absolutely expose those to the highest of their extent. So if our economy is going to be big and thriving like it used to in the coal days, probably not. But can we bring it in a framework, whether it's in the Big Sandy region or East Kentucky altogether, to where, you know, we are a dot on the map? You know, I've always told people there's three P's on UF 23. There's Paintsville, Preftonsburg, and Pikeville. And Paintsville is always the one that gets overlooked. Mm. Preftonsburg always have stuff going on. Pikeville always does. You have a college there. Preftonsburg, you have Moorhead's Big Sandy campus. We have Big Sandy right in our back door. So I think when we recognize that sometimes we have been out of the loop when it comes to development and, you know, just making sure we maintain what we have, but also bringing in new ideas and new perspectives. You know, we have a really good staff with our city tourism. Just a really good staff overall. I mean, you know, utilities, when we absorbed Johnson County Water and Utilities, you know, a lot of people are working on a very short time frame. You know, we have, you know, boil water advisories once a week in the county, and I think that we have to come together for the greater good, you know, because what's good for the city is good for the county. What's good for the county is good for us, because without the county seat of Paintsville, Johnson County wouldn't have a lot. Not to say that the county doesn't produce, they do. But given the revenue and the employment and everything else we have, I think that we have to come together. And, you know, a lot of this bleeds over into, you know, school allegiances, whether it's Johnson Central or Paintsville or Paintsville versus Johnson Central. And I think that we have to take off our jerseys and our, and, you know, all of our sporting or competitive nature off when we're in these positions. Because don't get me wrong, I'm a proud Paintsville graduate. My grandparents on my dad's side, my grandma Betty and my papa, taught at Johnson Central. So, like, I understand that dynamic, and rightfully so. I mean, everybody cares about their kid, their grandkid, whoever, and they want them to succeed in whatever facet that is. You know, I was, you know, really sweating bullets at Crook Creek Hall. There's people sweating bullets on the basketball court. It doesn't matter what it is. But in my opinion, you know, a lot of those allegiances have been to our downfall. And I think that those have to be completely stripped away. You know, because there's people in the city that proudly send their kids to Johnson Central, and there's people in the county that proudly send their kids to Paintsville. All of those allegiances have to be dropped. Because one thing, too, is both school systems are in the city limits. Because that's where we have the most viable land. So when we're talking about, you know, bringing the community together, I mean that in every instance. Because, you know, if we can't come together as a county and a city together as one whole community, then, I mean, it's not going to pan out in ways that would be preferable. And I think that that's one thing we've seen, that we're recognizing that that has been to our downfall, and just coming together in whatever facet that is, whether it's grant money coming in from the county, whether it's collaborative efforts, like we donated as a city $5,000 and the county donated $5,000 to offset the cost of food banks because of the SNAP debacle that they were dealing with federally. So, you know, whatever it is to uplift the community in whatever ways we can, or just coming up with framework of strategic planning for the next couple of years. You know, we can't just sit around and hope something big is going to come our way. We have to be realistic and you know, pragmatic, if you will, on how to, you know, devise our future. And I think that's the way that we get things done.
I see three key components of leadership, what I call my three M's, being an effective motivator, a competent manager, and a supportive mentor. So like motivator, manager, mentor. How do you view those three roles? And do you see them as like three things that are tied together?
Yeah, I do. I think when you are motivating folk, you know, we're in a region where typically the idea of government coming in and helping is not the most pleasant idea. Whether it is as local as city council or if it be the federal government, you know, we've always had, you know, concerns and superstitions on it, and I can't really blame them. So I think it's to motivate people that change can happen. It is possible, but it's the matter of trusting the process or either working to change the process in the way that we do things. And that could be getting involved with a campaign or a political party, or that is just simply going to your local meetings, you know, writing me letters, calling me, you know, getting a hold of me or anybody else on the council or any localized government, and just giving up your concerns. I can't govern for the people if I don't know what the people care about. You know, I can't fix a road that I don't know has a pothole. You know, I can't fix utilities that I don't know are not working. So, you know, I always want to be able to not just motivate people to get off the couch and vote, but get out and really be an engaged citizen. Because, you know, that is one thing that, you know, I think our generation and others have taken for granted, that even my grandparents did. You know, I mean, they voted in every election. They were always up to date on what the candidate stood for, what people were doing, and if they weren't doing anything, hold them accountable. And I think that we're seeing a reverse of that. We're seeing that come back a little bit. But I think in the most local level, even if it's a nonpartisan office, you know, hold us accountable. If there's something that I have not done that you want to see done, let me know. And I've always told people that. I'm one mind. I'm one individual. I cannot decide the city's future in just my hands, because, one, I wouldn't be comfortable doing that. But also, I don't know what matters to every section of town. I don't know what matters to every section of the county or in East Kentucky, if we're talking about something that, if working with multiple different counties and city governments. So that would be what I would say about motivate. Mentoring, whether it's me seeking mentorship, because, you know, rightfully, I've not even been on the council for a year. So I think rightfully, you know, seeking out people who have been in government of any kind, and seeking out what they would suggest in certain scenarios, or in certain regards or policy points, whatever it may be. Budgeting, especially, that was one big thing we dealt with our budget coming up. That we just finished off of. And then mentoring, you know, local people to realize that they can get involved in the process, whether it's young people. There's a lot of young folks I know in East Kentucky that are running for offices that they never thought they would run for, because there's people like me and others that stepped up in ways that they didn't deem possible at this young of an age. But also mentoring people that may be older than me that thought that they were always shut out of the political process. But if I can do it at 20, they can, you know, rightfully do it at the age of 45 or 50. And I think just breaking that cycle of, I cannot be a part of this, this is above me, to being that this is not above you, you're equal to it. You just have to be, you know, able to figure out what role suits you, you know, whether it's as low as Soil Water Commission or school board all the way up to, you know, the presidential, you know, whatever your aspirations are, let's be realistic, fine-tune them and make sure that you have the best fit, that will not just serve you and your family well in that work-life balance, but also serve your community in the best way. And then what was your third one?
Manager,
yes. I think that, one, as a council of six, and then if there were to be a tie, which there have not been, most everything we've done have been unanimous, is, you know, managing ourselves together, making sure that we all have the right priority and direction, and also people managing me. You know, not this closed door behind the scenes yuckiness, but literally just people managing what I prioritize. Whether it's people messaging me or calling me about, you know, a pothole or, you know, issues of drainage or whatever it may be, something that City Works deals with. Is it utilities? Are you having issues with water, with heat, with electric? You know, things that matter to people on a daily that normally does not seem like, you know, a political body can fix, but we're the ones that do it. We're the ones that appropriate the money to put, you know, the blacktop on that pothole and fix it. We're the ones that help get utilities the money to drill up a pipe, redo it, and fix the street back. So I think it's just letting people, me managing my constituents, which is everybody in the city of Paintsville, a little over 4,000 people, of what we realistically can do as a local city body, but also what I need to be doing with their problems and their concerns, or things that they just have questions about that just have not been fulfilled yet, about just the status update on things. You know, that was a big question on the flood wall, which have still been kind of in a stagnant position. But, you know, other things that typically we would see a lot more faster process, but because of loss of grant, because of construction cost, you know, and the issues of inflation with a lot of things that we pay for to get things done with, just being transparent on, you know, what things are taking so long or why things are panning out the way that they are.
How do you sort of embrace like global identity or even being a global citizen in your work here locally? And like, in what ways do global events shape what you're doing here in Johnson County?
I think the issue of trade hurts really bad. You know, we're dealing with issues of construction costs going through the roof, things that are typically imported into the United States. You know, whether you're talking about heavy machinery equipment, whether you're talking about individual parts and electronics, you know, the typical fees that we incur with just a bit over $2.5 million, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room. And without grant money or private investment or what have you, you know, we're pretty limited in what we can realistically incur when it comes to price increases for things that we typically need for city services and projects. So that is one thing that I see globally harming things, you know, potentially even if it's something in regard to gasoline and oil, you know, if it's something that happens, say, in the Middle East or whatever, really just hurting the consumer, the local mm-hmm. consumer, whether it's us needing to reimburse our fire department for diesel that they're using for a fire truck, or whatever it may be, or if it's just us having simple grievances as citizens of the U.S. with, you know, gas prices, whatever it may be, on that front. But typically, I would say just the issues when it comes to trade, and how that can harm, you know, just our local budget, because that is things that we desperately need for projects, whether it's getting our splash pad put in before the spring to go and couple that with the city pool, or if it's just redoing roads, you know, putting in, you know, new piping, getting rid of the cast iron and lead piping that we've had in our ground for years, decades. Some of those cast iron pipes were put in the 1920s, so we're nearing about 100-year-old infrastructure in some areas, which is not too uncommon in eastern Kentucky, but just dealing with the issues of price increases when it comes to, you know, fulfilling what we need to on the daily.
And what lessons do you think states like Kentucky can offer to sort of broader policy conversations, you know, to show the rest of the U.S., but also the world, like what can we offer to public policy and leadership?
I think realistically is that there has been this narrative in the last little bit that you have to have all the money and all the connections to get involved. And I don't subscribe to that idea because, you know, there are typically, you know, we have the history in the Appalachian region or eastern Kentucky or Kentucky as a whole of not really taking no for an answer You know, I remember, you know, stories that my great-grandmother, I call it Grandma, she telling me stories of my great-grandfather, Bill Blair, ended up having to work down in Breathitt County to mine coal because the Van Leer mines were on strike, you know, with the UMWA, which he was a member. But it was to the point that he couldn't afford to be off work to protest, so we had to drive all the way to Breathitt County in the 1950s to get work in the coal mines. So, you know, I'm not too unfamiliar of us, you know, standing up for what's right. And I think at a time with this, when families are pushed to the margins when it comes to being able to afford the basic needs that they need, and not just basic needs, but the basic practices of life. You know, being able to afford that summer vacation, birthday gifts, Christmas. I mean, I saw that there was some commentator on Fox Business that said, don't buy grandma that Christmas gift. We can't afford it this year. You know, I mean, realistically, just having that basic, what would be quintessentially American way of life. You know, always having a little bit of excess, being able to, you know, provide everything you need for the basics of your family. But, you know, bringing in those extra things that make, you know, life a better way. In a better, you know, time for you and your family, or just the community, whether it's, you know, donating to charity or whatever it may be. You know, and that's kind of where I talk about this, is that we have a lot of issues that I think should be addressed in Congress, but just are not right now. I think that there's a lot of issues that are being exacerbated by Congress, whether it's cuts to SNAP and Medicaid. But, you know, there's an issue that we've seen for a long time is right to repair, which is local farmers and mechanics being pretty much relegated to sending their farm equipment or vehicles to a dealer because they are not, they're in a legally binding contract that will not let them even have maintenance on their vehicle by themselves. And that's one thing that I've seen in Congress be brought up every now and then in the past couple, you know, 4 or 5 years. But that goes against a lot of the corporations that typically donate to members of Congress, like John Deere and, you know, other large vehicle and machinery manufacturers. So that's one thing I've heard from a lot of folks I know down in Western Kentucky with a lot of their farmers, as well as just regular car mechanics. You know, there's some vehicles that you're just not able to even do typical maintenance on yourself. You have to send it to the dealer. And then, you know, when you're dealing with issues of, you know, affordability, you know, right now, you know, Kentucky Power is trying to put a 15% rate hike on all consumers in the Kentucky Power District, which disproportionately is hurting Eastern Kentucky consumers of, you know, their electrical service. And we are the highest rated individuals within that service boundary. So the poorest counties in Kentucky in their service district are the highest charged already, not counting the 15% increase that they're already trying to lobby against consumers. So I think the issue of just how expensive things have got in such a short amount of time. I mean, just basic necessities of life have pretty much been unattainable for people. And I think, how do we get involved in that process? Find a group, you know, find an advocacy group, you know, whether it is inherently political for one side or the other. If it's an interest group, say that, you know, solely based with their lobbying on healthcare or environment or whatever it may be. But you yourself, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, it's wasting your time to call Hal Rogers' office or call Rand Paul or Mitch McConnell's office. But every now and then, you will see things change. You know, they've talked about this bluegrass resistance in this mm-hmm. new Congress. You know, Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell and Thomas Massie, most notably Paul and Massie, being the stopgap for a lot of things going on in Congress right now, or at least being the sole proprietors of resistance on the Republican side. So I think that when you put the right pressure, things do change, or things just never happen that were intended to, that would disproportionately affect people. I heard that President Trump was supposed to give out his health care plan that we've been waiting on since 2016, just this week. And because so many Congress people in rural districts were being called and exacerbating them out by their constituents about issues of cutting Medicaid, getting rid of those ACA subsidies, they canceled the press conference mm-hmm. that was supposed to announce that big package that would replace the Affordable Care Act. So I think that when you put pressure where pressure is due and necessary, that even in a state where people say it's, you know, gerrymandered, it's very Republican, things can still happen. when you all work together on an issue that matters to you. And that can be very different issues. It can be something that is a more conservative ideal, or it could be a more liberal or progressive sense, or it could just be common sense things that need to get done that anybody would subscribe to. But I would just say, you know, find where you're needed and find what you want to get done and, you know, execute a plan with a group or just advocate on behalf of yourself.
And, you know, hearing about you talk about how these cuts have affected Eastern Kentucky from food benefits to the hospitals, and you being a leader here and also a student, I was curious about how you've seen sort of growing challenges and conflicts around diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI initiatives, you know, like both globally, but here in the U.S. and the attacks we're seeing on it from like the federal level, but also the state level, and like the cuts to DEI funding and policy pushback. How have you like viewed those, and has that impacted your work, or have you seen that as impacting Eastern Kentucky in education?
I see it impacting education in Appalachia, just typically, because, you know, a lot of people assume DEI is people that do not look like you or have came from the circumstances that you have been dealt. And what I have given as the prime example to completely shift the narrative is that West Virginia University was forced under the DEI law that passed in West Virginia, or the anti-DEI law that passed in West Virginia, to completely close down their Appalachian Studies department. That is what I have told people as the main prime example of what the implications of DEI are. If people are in some ways not cognizant of other groups being affected, but look at what's happening to our set of the population. You know, studies that have archived so much of our cultural history of labor movements that we have participated in other issues, you know, all of that is being relegated to being non-existent completely. And I have turned to that with a lot of people who typically would not be a fan of what typically have always been catered to as DEI. So softening the blow of what typically would be the boogeyman of DEI for people that are worried about what they've heard, and telling them really the implications that hurts on our group of the population. You know, poor white working class people is a minority in the United States. You know, not a racial minority, but a minority of the population when you're talking about differences in class and geography. You know, the Appalachian region have always been underdeveloped and disproportionately and predominantly underserved, you know, whether it is by the corporations that mine our coal, cut our lumber, or harvest industry, but also from the government in many cases. So that's what I normally use for people. But at Morehead State, it's very hard to see any positives from this. When I see people say that, you know, we have saved post-secondary education from, you know, cutting all these programs, because Morehead State, being on student government, they did a report at the start of the year, I believe in early September, that showed that we had the smallest international student population that we had had in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I can't really blame a family for not wanting to come into a space where their culture, their sense of place and being, is completely ripped away from an academic institution that you want to send your child to. Especially when we have always been, at least in the last century, a place that you can send a family member from what is typically a nation or a place in the world that faces a lot of issues, that does not have a structured education system in a lot of places to lift them out of poverty or the subjugation they faced, and slowly but surely get educated, reside in the United States, and move their family to the United States for the betterment of themselves, that narrative has completely flipped on its head, that we want to completely isolate ourselves. And we've been down this period before. I mean, you have to look at, you know, Woodrow Wilson and, you know, that era. Ironically, that was in the 1920s. So, you know, you have to, you know, take 100 years later, you know, same playbook, different style, different populations. But I think that when you look at this, I frankly see it as a complete just opposite of what America has stood for Now, don't get me wrong, we've had our problems. You know, we've had our bad moments in history. But by and large, we should be a place that is literally in what have always been called the melting pot of society, that people can come to the United States or just live in the United States. If they were, you know, their family immigrated here, they were born in the United States by, you know, from their parents, that they should be proud to be here and not scared that they're relegated to the margins of society just because they're not what is considered the typical American experience in some people's eyes. And that's what I've seen in post-secondary education, but also just generally. I know that our Big Sandy Community and Technical College, they've had a lot of programs and the student services pulled from statewide funding because of that. And it's mainly just student supports, helping certain groups of the population that would be, you know, boxed in to the what would be like the DEI community that is normally prescribed to in the media or what have you. So I see it as a negative impact. Some people would clearly disagree with me on that, but I just can't rightfully see a lot of families that I know that I, you know, went to high school with. A good number of them, they either immigrated to the United States or they were the fourth generation to live in the United States as full citizens, that or native-born citizens, that I just can't in good conscience see how any of that is good to society. That's just my worldview. I don't see how that is in any way a good for us. Because we've always been known, you know, bring us here, you know, tired, huddled masses, you know, that we've always what we've etched into the Statue of Liberty, and you know that's what my family subscribed to. They were poor farmers in, you know, Germany and Ireland and Scotland, you know, the most white you probably can get, you know, the most Anglo-Saxon you can get. And that's just the universal experience. That's what the United States have been founded on and what we have typically used of our principles. Now we have reverted in ways and regressed in certain ways. But I just see anti-DEI stuff as mainly just against having a collective society instead of just having a unicameral society where everybody believes the same way, everybody lives the same way. That's never been the United States. You know, you may talk about, you know, the colonial period where everybody had the same Protestant beliefs. Not really. You know, when you're really looking at the main people that came over and why they came to the United States, whether it was pre-colonial or after, or you're talking about coming to the United States when we founded and after, I just have issues with that. You know, my papa taught history and social studies in high school. He taught a little bit at Morehead State, his alma mater, my family's continuing alma mater. And that's just something I know that he was not a fan of. And people say, well, that's because you're a liberal thinker. My papa was a proud Republican. You know, he was elated when my sister Reagan was born because they named him after Ronald Reagan. You know, I mean, it was a uniquely American belief. And unfortunately, it has become a partisan viewpoint if you care about a multicultural United States. And that shouldn't be the case. But I think in the last little bit, we have seen that kind of isolationist rhetoric slowly rear its ugly head again. And people look at it as populism and, you know, if it negative, if it positive. Sometimes populism is an inherent good, especially when people have lost their jobs and they feel as if that our country have been dealt a bad deal. NAFTA, other issues that have pulled people's realities away from them. But it also can rear its ugly head when you're trying to find an enemy to blame. Not blaming the decisions that the government have made, that we as a nation have decided to support, but trying to find the boogeyman that we can point to the blame that if not ourselves. And I think that's the main reason that we're seeing the onslaught of anti-DEI stuff, is that we're trying to find somebody that we can blame for problems we have not been willing to recognize of, you know, our own, if that makes sense.
And you spoke earlier about the importance of, like, finding our communities if we want to, you know, be a leader or make change. So I want to, continuing off of that, what advice do you have for, like, individuals, but also organizations and movements who want to put Kentucky, particularly Eastern Kentucky, on the global map and just show the world, you know, what we have to offer here in Kentucky, especially for young people?
I will say talk to people, not talk at them. That is one main thing that I've told a lot of people that have come with grassroots groups come into Appalachia that are from more urban centers. You can't walk up to the door and tell somebody you're from Louisville. That's probably not going to go very well if you go up the holler and try and talk to somebody. You have to level with people. give them a real reason and a concern and a mindset that matters to them, and just hear them out. Is it, if what is going to come out of their mouth, probably everything you're going to believe or something that you deem important? Maybe not. But I think that we have been in Appalachia very stereotyped and very relegated to this idea that we are very backwards, you know, violent people that, you know, are not civilized in society. You know, I am in a film class at Morehead State where we look at solely films that, you know, are focused on Appalachia, whether produced within, you know, Appalachian folk or from outsiders. And, you know, they always treat Appalachia, even now in today's media, almost like it's David Attenborough in a zoo. You know, look at these interesting specimens. And that, to me, just continues the stereotypes we've dealt with, you know, since the Beverly Hillbillies. And you can go back even farther than that, you know, even to the Civil War. And even before that with colonial stereotypes of Appalachia. But I think the main generalization I would give there is make sure that you know what matters to people before you come here. You don't treat it as a shock. You don't treat it as, well, that's not really, you know, of much importance. You know, that's really not what we came here for. Or that's really not the way that we derive our policy. You know, some people will talk about environmental issues and they immediately are turned off because completely, you know, our complete economy have been dominated by coal. In arguing to people that we need to completely subside the usage of coal, well, you already killed the conversation before you started it. You know, you have to level with people if their lived experience. If that is where their family is drawing their money from, if that's where their men and women in their family have been employed from, you have to level with people. And that's the problem even when you talk about it in the political sense. You know, there's a lot of times, and our governor has done very well about talking about it, is for far too long Democrats have been very good at knowing the problem, but we market it in a way that is very corporate, that is very analytical when it doesn't have to be. We talk in acronyms and in big, you know, think tank ideas and theories and all this stuff that just completely have tone deaf to working people. And I think that's the way that we have to govern and, you know, produce ourselves when we are, you know, working in whatever groups to find some kind of collective action. If leveling with the people that we want to have our knowledge and our data based upon, but also making sure that we let them know the implications of what we're doing. You know, hey, we're going to advocate on behalf of you. Are you okay with that? Let them know that not just we're coming in here, we're going to use you as a spectacle and we're going to, you know, exacerbate your experiences to put on mass media or, you know, a big campaign of, you know, advocating for certain policy. But let them know that they can be in that process too. Because a lot of people in Appalachia have been very, and, you know, I'm even still a victim of this too, that there's some things that you're like, I don't think I should deal with that. You know, that's not for me. But just making sure that you can break that course of people feeling as if that they're helpless, that they have been so relegated to being isolated from processes of being an advocate, of being an active member in a political sense of their community. And, you know, community can be different. That can be city, that can be county, that can be, you know, the nation as a whole. But just making sure that not only you're taking their lived experience as it is, but also recognizing the main importance of letting them get involved as well. Not just taking their data and going home and celebrating, but also incorporating their viewpoints as well and bringing them into the fold.
I really like hearing that refrain of like lived experience you mentioning from hearing from people here in Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky, but also from young people. And I was curious, you know, thinking of like lived experience and like, you know, what when people sharing their stories, are there any books or publications that you look to that have shaped your leadership philosophy?
Leadership philosophy, I would say that there's a couple of books that I've read, whether it's Appalachia focused or a certain kind of political bend. One of the main ones that my papaw absolutely loved, and I have multiple copies of it, because my papaw was a very quirky and eccentric individual. Not in a fancy way, but that's just how he organized and relegated himself to in his life. He would have three different copies of a book, of the same book. One he would read, one he would take notes in, and the other one he would keep of an extra copy in his bookshelf. So when he passed, we had thousands of books we had to go through, and half of them were the exact same book. but that's just the way he was, and he would always, he wrote a book in, I believe the date was 1962, about the Jenny Wiley captivity in Johnson and Floyd County and the implications of, you know, the new frontier here in, you know, Appalachia when we opened up. From the Cumberland Gap. And, you know, he always would give me copies of this book. Every so many birthdays, he would write a thing on the front cover and he would wish me happy birthday. And he would do that with other books, or even to my dad or my nan or somebody. And they slowly came to me after he passed, of me looking through, just remembering his handwriting in the way that he would, you know, formulate sentences, and just really the care that he took into exhibiting himself. But the main book that he loved was Night Comes to the Cumberlands by Harry and Cottle from Perry County, pretty much talking about coming in as a lawyer and dealing with the abject poverty that was at the time. I mean, this was before the war on poverty. You know, this was before Medicaid. This was before food stamps. I mean, we were dealing with, you know, people being stuck in almost a 19th century way of life. You know, no running water, no electricity, pretty much being stuck in the same stability and instability of life that they were as children in the 1910s, 1920s during the Great Depression and you know, the economic issues there. So, you know, recognizing where we have came from in such a very short amount of time in eastern Kentucky. I mean, you know, my great-grandmother went only up to the eighth grade in Van Leer, and I have had AP classes and dual credit, and I'm in college. You know, it's only been two or three generations where the majority of, you know, our Appalachian people have been able to garner as much as we have. And in a way, it is overwhelming, you know, the amount of technology and access to new things that we've had in just a very short amount of time. I mean, we're talking about less than 100 years of so much availability and access that we've garnered. But one of the main books that I've read that I really enjoy reading was Desk 88 by Sherrod Brown. He wrote about how he was on the 88th desk in the U.S. Senate right up against the wall. I remember when I went to D.C. and they let us go up in the balcony of the U.S. Senate, and I pointed to the desk. I'm like, there it is. I've seen it on C-SPAN all the time. There it is. And though he's not there, I hope he has a comeback next year. But he talked about kind of the legacy of, you know, Ted Kennedy sitting there. And, you know, throughout, you know, the decades, and even though the Senate is always noted as like an archaic institution, you know, everybody, you know, they deliberate for hours. Not a lot of things go on. They're all a bunch of old people. You know, it's just, you know, the very old way of politicking that even in some European countries is very naive to the way that they govern, you know, their parliament or their, even their Senate chambers. And just talking about how different, you know, liberal or progressive policy has persisted through the people that have literally sat at the same desk as him throughout the U.S. Senate's tenure. And that one I always thought was important to me because I always have enjoyed Sherrod Brown because, one, you know, I live partly in WYMT and WSAZ news coverage, so I would get a lot of news feed about what he's doing in Ohio, you know, because where we live so close to the tri-state area there with Ashland and Huntington and Portsmouth and Ironton, Ohio. And I have family that live in Cincinnati and Dayton. So, you know, looking at how he governed as kind of the working class champion in an area that, you know, have sharply went to Republicans. And next year, I hope that we see some reversion of that, especially with the issues of, you know, working class concerns. But, you know, really looking at how champions of rural ideals, and not just rural ideas, but just working class values, you know, growing up in a family that didn't have a lot, but it meant everything, you know, and I've even looked at information about Alvin Barkley, who was vice president from around the Paducah area with Harry Truman's vice president, U.S. Senator Carl Lee Perkins from Knott County. So a lot of people that came from abject poverty, not a lot, and you know, emphasized what we have today as, you know, an ideal that was not very popular at the time. and forced it through the hall of Congress to the Resolute Desk and changed a lot of lives. You know, that's why we have Carl Lee Perkins Vocational Rehab. That's why we have what we had from the War on Poverty, you know, and Carl Lee came after the New Deal, but Alvin Barkley was Senate Majority Leader during the New Deal era. So, you know, it's always, to me, very important that you look at people that came from the coal fields of Appalachia and in Kentucky, rural Kentucky especially, and how we've been at the center point of a lot of good things that have come to this country. And it's not just a Democratic thing. You know, we're talking about, even though Illinois stole it from us, you know, literally the land of Lincoln, Henry Clay, you know, so many different visionaries in our government have come straight from the Commonwealth of Kentucky, or what was at the time, you know, a portion of Virginia, or, you know, a new territory that had yet been claimed. So I think just looking at how important it is that when people tell you, the pundits and the mass media say that, you know, Kentucky, you know, it's going to be always relegated to Republican control. They've always going to be this overarching conservative theme. We have always proven that wrong. It is true that, yes, we, you know, have a majority Republican registration. We have voted overwhelmingly on the federal level for Republicans. But when you have the right policy, when you have the right upbringing, and taking that upbringing to level with other people's issues and what they've lived through, we've had a lot of good people come out of rural Kentucky that have been able to change lives. For, you know, people that have persisted for 100 years after their passing, or almost 100. You know, when you're talking about Alvin Barkley, he died in 1953, I believe, 1956 possibly. So, I mean, you know, decades later, way after, you know, their time on this earth, being able to have a lasting impact. So that's what I look up to. And even people that are still living that are out of elected office, you know, like Sherrod Brown or John Tefter from Montana, just those kind of important leaders that have led the way for a lot of good things to happen for people who are typically left behind in that process.
It's fascinating hearing about those books and those readings. Are there any also leadership lessons you've picked up from, like, your favorite movies or TV shows or, like, pop culture resources?
Yes, I will say that I grew up with a family that always loved a good classic film. Always loved a documentary or a series. I would say that I have the essence of detail that you would get from a Ken Burns documentary on PBS, with sometimes the sternness of any one of the characters on Law and Order SVU. Our two cats are Finn and Olivia, so they rightfully have claim to that. And then mainly on that front, I mean, just cherishing the importance of where you come from and, you know, looking at different films that have, you know, challenged narratives of rural people. You know, I know that a lot of people have had mixed feelings about, you know, Hillbilly Elegy and other things that have depicted our area or our people. But really just recognizing the uniqueness of where we come from. And when you talk about, you know, mass media in that sense, there have been a lot of things to downgrade us as a people without even knowing us or not even introducing us as a people, just immediately, you know, inserting those kinds of generalizations. But, you know, the main thing for me is taking a look at the footage in the documentaries that Apple Shop has in Letcher County and other local media archivists. You know, my papa was a proud member of the Big Sandy Historical Society, and there were a lot of things that, you know, unfortunately and literally died with them. Things that they held on to, ideas, and things that were never documented, but were in their mind. And I think that it's important, especially in an area where we have garnered so much when it comes to technology, in such a very short amount of time, of preserving all of that. That we can live up to that. I watched Harlan County, USA about a month ago in my film class for the second time that I've seen it. And every time that I see snippets from that, it always gives me different mixed emotions, you know, about families literally on the picket line, life or death, hoping that they can get better for themselves and their children, especially at a time when if you spoke up against, you know, your employer, you were pretty much if, you know, kicked off into the road. You know, you lost your home from the coal company, you lost your job. And that was, you know, all she wrote about your prospects in life. So I think if really looking at where we've came from, when you look at those old film reels and rhetoric that you've seen against Appalachian people, and really just proving it wrong. You know, ironically, the idea of people not even having shoes in Appalachian persists. You know, I was asked that question when I went to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I was like, I'm not even that far out of the Appalachian region. You know, this is interesting. And then my papaw was asked that when he was at his graduation at the University of Kentucky in 1953, after he came back from Germany in the U.S. military. So it's those persisting things that always have tried to put us down, that have always tried to make sure that we're not involved in, you know, the decision-making and the policy-making of how we conduct ourselves in this country, especially because a lot of those issues, you know, disproportionately hurt our people or people like us that have been, you know, thrown to the margins of society. That it's very important to prove they're wrong and even use things that within that media source that backs up your claim. You know, whether it is looking at footage of Eula Hall with Big Sandy Healthcare, with the Mud Creek Clinic, and Carl Lee Perkins, they have a lot of, you know, floor speeches of his that's been preserved. And just looking at how our communities have came together, whether for flood or, you know, other circumstances, really making sure that we show that we are a resilient people, and not just the stereotypes that we've unfortunately had to deal with for, you know, nearly 100 years with mass media.
And you've mentioned a number of leaders you look up to, particularly local and national leaders. Are there any, like, global leaders that inspire you?
Global. I would say I'm one of those people that I try and stay in tune with global politics, but I've always stood with the philosophy in my mind, and this even happens when people ask me to run for, like, national and statewide positions with Young Democrats or other things, that until my people in East Kentucky are taken care of, that's my main focus, until things were to persist. So a lot of times I look at what is unfortunately occurring on the global stage, and I just tune it out. Mm-hmm. One, for my betterment, but also that, you know, when there's people that live, you know, down the street from me that probably haven't ate in a week, and looking at the abject issues across the globe, it's the same thing, but I know that I can directly impact the local. And I do keep up with the issues that happen in, you know, the Middle East, that are happening in Europe right now, in Asia. You know, and that's one thing that has kind of impacted our generation, whether it's the issue of Ukraine and Russia and Israel and Gaza, that's been the two most prevalent global things that we've dealt with in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years. But I will say that it's always been interesting to me how, not really as a mentor, but just generally looking at him as an individual, how Zelensky came to power. You know, he was a celebrity, you know, and ironically, we have dealt with, you know, a celebrity come to the highest office in the land, and it has panned out very differently. But I will say that it's very interesting, the rhetoric against him and just how resilient of a people they are. And, you know, that does go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union and, you know, all of that and statehood and, you know, these continuing back and forth battles, especially when Putin came to power in 2000. As president then, when they had actual elections, not getting 99% of the vote and calling that democracy. But I do think that has been a very interesting note with me, and also the influence and influx of a lot of women coming up in the last little bit, like Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico. Mm-hmm. The new, I believe, prime minister of Japan is a female, even though she is more of on the right side of politics, even farther to the right than what would be considered a American right. So just interesting that we have, in a good chunk of the world, kind of subsided that idea of that women are not a part of the process, and it just being you are a member of parliament and you will be a leader of this nation. And seeing that kind of difference that we see in the United States, where that still seems like a barrier that we haven't been able to fully cross yet. So that's been an interesting global aspect that I've seen in the last little bit. Because typically it's been the assumption that, you know, that you're going to have this Democratic nominee that's a woman that's going to run, and then you see the very more what would be labeled in Europe the far-right leader, you know, they're the female, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, I believe the prime minister of Italy or president of Italy, in that kind of ideal of that, this kind of universal political acceptance of female leaders on a global scale, when even in the United States we're still kind of in this hope phase of it may happen, you know, but them having these very concrete examples in the last little bit materializing.
And, you know, you're still, you know, still early in college, but do you know what your plans are after you graduate and your future plans for leadership?
Well, I will say this. I hope that I am scheduled at Morehead State to graduate in December of 2027. So I have a little bit, but I know along the way that I've, you know, considered many different options. And I'm one of those people that, knowing how things can pop up with family or otherwise, I normally have two or three options so that if one door closes, I can go through another and not just have to break down the wall, you know, just, you know, not completely pursuing one ideal and something come up and then have to completely reevaluate things, but having a backup plan. One of the main things that I've really looked at is trying to find, you know, the effective balance of possibly law school or graduate school. That is something that my papaw went to. He went for graduate school for education. I had one seminar left in his senior class to finish and ended up not pursuing it because we realized he'd probably be a little too overqualified to teach high school education. So, you know, we've, you know, almost been on the cusp of that before in our family, but just never reaching it for rightful reason. That was his pursuit. But, you know, I would love to, I have two parents that have worked in the criminal side of the justice system for the state of Kentucky in different facets, as well as family court. So dealing with a lot of very emotional and very complicated ways of handling issues in the community. And that's one thing that I probably will not pursue, just because that's it tanks everybody around. I will say that. It's a very hard way of going, but it's a very noble work. You know, making sure that you preserve a community and keep things secure and safe. But civil law would probably be my choice, if that is to be a reality. Regardless of that, I will be living here. This is not just, you know, being elected government here and then go to college and go to grad school and move to Lexington and then, you know, web my life over there. That's not my position. I will hopefully, unless anything were to change with family or anything else, live in Paintsville. Now, what does that entertain for me? I don't know yet. But I would like to say that I'd be able to contribute to, you know, helping those that normally cannot help themselves, whether that's with pro bono work or in a different field, whether with a nonprofit or some other group, to be able to achieve that. But right now, not really settling for one direction, because knowing me, I need about one or two different alternatives in case something pops up.
That's good. That's great that you have that backup plan. And you, of course, have so many options for your future and what you can succeed in. I'm really excited that, you know, to hear from a fellow academic team competitor. I was at Johnson Central, the quick recall and academics there. I was curious what your subjects were.
I'm with arts and humanities and social studies. I variated between quick recall and FPS throughout the last couple of years if we had enough people. But social studies were my main, that was my the Mac Daddy of them all. And then arts and humanities, I tried to dabble a little bit in the language arts. It got too grammatical for me. I was like, yeah, we're going to leave that to the pros. So, but mainly social studies and arts and humanities were my two fields of study.
That's awesome. My sister was a leader in future problem solving in FPS. And I think they won internationals one year. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was math and social studies, primarily social studies. And I'm like, well, that led me to studying the one subject in college that combines them, economics.
So. I mean, you can't beat that. I mean, if one goes with the other, might as well pursue it.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah, happy to have a fellow social studies nerd with me. And we started this interview with your 6-word story. Now I want to hear, what is your 6-word legacy? The 6 words that you hope people will remember when they reflect on you and your impact on Kentucky and the world?
My 6-word obituary statement. What would that consist of? I would hope it would be written as, he did what he could for the least, with the least among us. That's what I've always been prescribed to You know, my grandmother, when she was teaching elementary school, she would, over right before the start or the end of the school year, she would compile lists of names of students that needed certain products or certain things at their home, whether it was food, whether it was hygiene products, clothing, whatever it would be. And she would bag them all, put them in the back of her car, and discreetly give it to the kids, because that was before they were family resource office. You know, and my grandmother, who is literally a coal miner's daughter, she, you know, they'd just open up their home to everybody in the holler and all the family to come in and eat and care for, you know, any neighbor that needed it. And that's been an underlying theme in my life. And me and my dad are both Masons and Shriners. And I was a patient at Lexington Shriners Hospital for scoliosis. Oh. So giving back to what has given me so much has been what's important, and what have given me so much of this community. And we've unfortunately been in a situation where there's a lot of families that need a lot of help. And I hope that regardless of whatever life takes me or that path may be, that it can help people that typically are, you know, pushed to the side or kind of left to their own device, that something in whatever I do can help them in whatever way possible.
I think, yeah, we can definitely see that. And this, your reflection on Eastern Kentucky and also how you're, you know, shouting out your family and the leadership that they've espoused is just really inspirational to hear.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that, you know, when you're dealing with a family that has been through a lot, that, one, you have to thank them for what they gave you. Mm-hmm. You know, things are not perfect. And when you're dealing with families that were put into small family farms, coal mining and lumber and the railroad companies, they didn't have a lot, but what they had, they used a lot of to help anybody around them. So, I mean, that's been, you know, the family kind of ideals for a very long time, probably since that we came over to the United States. But generally, from what I've been told, at least up until my great-grandparents, at least what have been spoken to me. I know some of that has probably been lost into history, but it's been a good run, and I hope that we can continue that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're doing a great job continuing it. Councilmember Hazlett, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. Happy it worked out that we're both in back home at the same time, and just got to getting to meet you has been such a great honor.
Well, thank you. I hope you and yours have a good holiday season, and hopefully we don't have a snowmageddon this year, but if we do, I hope the roads get clean for you.
Yeah, same with you. Thank you so much.
Welcome.
That wraps up my conversation with Nicholas Hazlett. As a young leader, he brings a thoughtful, forward-looking perspective to local governance, and he pushes for lofty, pragmatic goals that keep future generations in mind. I recorded this interview back home at my parents' house in Johnson County, which made the conversation feel even more special. And we actually didn't even stop talking when the mics turned off. Nick and I kept talking about what's happening back home, and then my cousin Zaif Hussein happened to drop by. Zaif's also a college student, the same age as Councilman Hazlett. He's at the University of Pikeville. And it was just great to hear the both of them talk about what's going on back home and their love of Eastern Kentucky. And to hear them bounce ideas off each other was just electric. I wish I was able to record that part of the conversation and share it with you as well. Just wanted to shout out Zaif. My next episode drops in March, and it features Kelly McManus, the Vice President of Higher Education at Arnold Ventures. Until then, remember to live local and think global, fellow changemakers.